thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 76 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 25th of February, 2022. I am Conal O'Moran, and on this edition, a mixed bag, where we have top guests coming from everywhere, including our first fly-in from the US, another who has hot-tailed it from Limerick, and a final guest who has torn himself away from the forecourts to talk to us about the value of a signature. Huge response again on LinkedIn to our Olympians, Katie and Hannah, who joined us on episode 75. To talk about sponsorship and sport. I can tell you, there's a lot of love out there for you ladies. And if you haven't listened, please do, particularly where members of a national team that gives us so much pride asks for a hockey pitch. That's all they want, one that they can call a home of their own. Quite disgraceful, there isn't one at the moment. And all of the great business insights on this podcast are brought to you thanks to our own sponsor, DeFacto Shaving Oil. Man or woman, it's the best anyone can get. Buy it right now on DeFactoShave.com. Now, as your business expansion plans grow, the obvious question is, where to next? Team GBS knows our strapline that all businesses should try to and must really get off the island. 7 million people here, 7 billion people plus over there. Simple maths. We previously had the South African ambassador on the podcast encouraging people to do business in her home country. And of course, as a founding member of the Ireland Connecticut Business Council, I try and help promote the state of Connecticut to Irish businesses as a convenient and great value beachhead to take on the North American markets. So I had a call on behalf of someone in the States who was expanding into the Irish market. And curiously, a business that eschews, oh, I love that word, eschews, major centres like New York City, Toronto or London, opting instead for Boston, Vancouver, and in this case, Dublin. Steve Connolly hangs his name over the door of Connolly Partners, headquartered in Boston, Massachusetts, that has just acquired Irish agency Zoo Digital. They'd hate to be called an advertising agency. They're a creative agency. And Steve literally is on a flying visit to Ireland, probably to check out what he has bought. Steve Connolly, welcome to That Great Business
Thanks.
Show.
Thanks so much, Reverend. And we're going to convince you to convert to Massachusetts from Connecticut. Give me time. I'll pull you over.
You have bought Zoo Digital. And it says that they are a full-service creative agency and award-winning. Have you ever seen a creative a creative agency that was not award-winning?
No, no one ever checks the awards. It could be punt, pass, and kick a football or a singing award. No, but these guys are the real deal. I will say that.
Well, that's because you've opened up your wallet to buy them, so they better be.
Open up my wallet.
You mean you didn't pay?
Of course I paid. Because it's all in trade. I paid them in chickens and two cows.
Well, because nowhere is mentioned anything at all about how much you paid.
Never do. I've done 12 acquisitions, and it's none of your business what I paid. And
oh, I love Americans.
We will. Let's put it this way. If this thing works, everybody's going to make more, and we think this one's going to work.
Why Dublin?
Well, I came here 10, 12 years ago originally to purchase an experiential agency because you guys are so much better at that.
Award-winning?
Of course they were award-winning. I think it was a painting award in third grade. No, we started, and I interviewed a couple of firms. And as it turns out, I went home and purchased a different agency instead that was more travel and tourism-based. And then Brexit happened, 22 years ago, whenever the hell it was. And it dawned on me that Dublin is about to become the largest English-speaking city in Europe. I bet you there's going to be some business fallout. Let's go check it out. So I hopped on a plane and came over. And I was blown away by the expansion of the market, the cranes, the glass, the big technology companies that have made their home here, did my homework. And I said, you know, Dublin and Tel Aviv happen to be the technology capitals of all of Europe. For tax reasons, for whatever reasons, I don't really care. It just is what is. And
we've just moved Tel Aviv into Europe, but we'll pass over that one.
I read the trades. We don't know. We have to figure out. There's other countries over there we got to be worried about right now.
So you very wisely, I think, told me before we started that you've come to Dublin not for sentimental reasons, not for heritage reasons, for purely commercial reasons.
Yes, I'm a mercenary.
Explain.
Well, I think the growth of the market is undeniable. The number of companies that have beachheads and headquarters here, undeniable. The technology smarts, the digital smarts that evolves in a market like Dublin has become, again, undeniable, best in class, world class.
Now, I'm going to stop you because I know a little bit about this industry. And I do know, say, with large technology companies, they frequently work with large agencies worldwide. So the fact that they may have a European HQ in Dublin means diddly squat. They'll take their marching orders either from London frequently or from the US of A.
Well, you're back. You're off by about 3-4 years. I mean, you're on network delay, brother. We got to. It's all about dough right now, and I think you get better value. I think that they've unbundled. I think a lot of major clients have unbundled. I think they parcel out different projects to different size agencies. They get better value. Holding companies are in a state of atrophy right now. They're in a serious acknowledgement of the fact that their revenue and their cost models don't match up. I'll give you an example. We pitched a global brand repositioning for Boston Scientific, all strategy done here out of Dublin at our existing agency here, brand and creative done out of Boston. We work pretty seamlessly together and won that piece of business. And that's just an example of how the markets have shifted. But I think clients are looking for creativity, but they're looking for creativity at a lower cost. And if you're part of a holding company, that's hard to do because you have certain obligations to your bottom line. Your obligations that are my company are to me, and we'll make the decisions that are in the best interest of the long-term health of the company, which means sometimes you lose money, sometimes you make money.
Curiously, you're not going to rebrand Zoo Digital.
Well, the only reason to change their name would be narcissism, and I have plenty of faults. We could fill plenty of podcasts on that, but narcissism isn't one of them. They're a great company. They have a great name. When and if it ever makes sense to change the name or adapt the name or us move and use part of that name, we'll let time dictate the best time to do that. But they have a great reputation. Why would I steal it?
Now, I know the easy, probably the simple answer is, of course, to my question that's coming up, is will you try to sell from here into the UK and or across Europe from here?
Yes, of course. However, I tried it about 3-4 years ago when we first came to the market. I had a shopper marketing company of some substance. And one of our three objectives in coming to Dublin was to launch shopper marketing into London, into the UK from our office here. And I found out pretty quickly that people in London look at everyone in Dublin like they're dragging their knuckles on the ground and they're picking their nose in their spare time.
We do a bit of that, Jim.
Which is another reason why I stay away from London. I stay away from New York. Even though Boston beats New York in every sporting event imaginable, they still have a sense of superiority, and I have no interest in playing on that field. So we got our ass kicked in London, and I think what we did, we closed that part of the business, and I think right now we're focusing on more blending between Dublin talent bases and Boston talent bases and Canadian talent bases. Eventually, the caliber of our ideas will speak for themselves. And if people want to find us, they know we're in the Portview House right over in Irishtown.
And if I understand correctly, the way that you operate, the kind of partners that operate, is that you try to buy those individuals, those creatives who specialize within sectors. Is that correct?
Many times, although sometimes you try to bring other people into the family that give you scale. While it's true that bigger companies are more open to hiring smaller firms. The reality is we're about 150 people, which gives us the ability to play on any playing field. Scale is important, and sometimes that means you're acquiring or bringing in people that do the same thing as you do. There's just more of you. In the case of Zoo, we had a digital offering. We were pretty good at our digital offering. They are better. They fill some holes for us. And I think that's going to help us with American clients as well as with our clients here.
Now, of course, I respect Zoo and their abilities, but what or how can they be better at digital than, say, a bunch of people in Boston and or in Vancouver?
Well, I'm not saying that they were better than all people in Boston, but their UX, their UA, their website construction, their process.
Hang on a second now. We have to start. We never use acronyms here. Otherwise, we'll be charging
$20
a shot for every acronym used.
A dollar. How much is a dollar going for here? I'm in euros, baby.
Oh, 20 euro is what we actually charge. So a UX is user experience. So just for our listeners, SME or SMB, as you might say, what does that user experience mean?
It's how, in its simplistic forms, and frankly, I got to be very clear. I'm a copywriter. So I'm a rube. And when it comes to some
You're
of these
a
things,
rube.
I'm a rube, a doofus, an idiot. I don't know these.
Okay, we don't use rubes.
We don't deal in rubes here. I go home and tell people it's good crack and they think I'm a drug addict. So I have to be careful on some of the transitions of words. But I think in its purest form, there's a certain way that people consume websites, how they progress through the website, how they engage at different points in the website, how you can maximize engagement at each page. And there's an art to that. There's a science to that. When you build the wireframe of a website, you're really building the blueprint of a house. And there's a certain specialty to that to maximize efficiency. And I think one other thing about Zoo, you know, I read their initial capabilities decks. We traded. That's what happens. You know, it's like you show me yours, I'll show you mine. I could have written theirs. It was philosophically very similar to our approach, which is a balanced approach between data science and anthropology, a respect for humanity. I think humanity has been marginalized by data in so many ways. It's like computers are trying to predict human behavior and okay, fine. But when you can find an algorithm that can tell me how Christie Brinkley married Billy Joel, I'm all in. But there's no logical reason for that. The man is hideous. She's gorgeous. But there's some magic pixie dust. There was an attraction. There is something chemical between the two of them. And I don't think an algorithm can explain that.
Now, you and I are both of an age, and I'm just
no
wondering.
No one knows who those two guys are.
Well, that's one thing. But secondly, I'm just wondering, are we just talking about something that is irrelevant because younger people, much younger people, don't really care? And the algorithm is just perfectly fine. And copywriters, no matter how wonderful, they don't care.
Do you have children?
I do.
And they are logical. I'm sure that every decision they make is based on logic analysis, assimilation of data, making a list, checking it twice, making sure that everything checks all the boxes. So you're definitely in the minority if that must be the case. I, on the other hand, have three kids that make decisions that are totally right brain, totally emotional. And like their father and mother, they're occasionally stupid. But they're what the right brain wants. And at the end of the day, the right brain's going to get what the right brain wants. And understanding I've always called it a seesaw, that however many data scientists you have on one side of the seesaw, you better have the same amount of anthropologists on the other side, because data is critical. Data science is critical. Analytics is critical. But if it's not balanced with the inherent illogic of human beings and acceptance of the fact that we do stupid things, then you're going to miss your opportunity to find that one. I mean, our job is to find the message that somebody's not going to ignore.
And a perfect segue for me, because I was explaining to you that we love our audience, our team GBS. And what I love providing for them particularly is free advice from world-class players like Steve Conley. Mm-hmm. So what should a small or medium enterprise be doing that they don't do in terms of getting messages across? Where do they waste time? Where do they waste money? And I'm going to roll in a third kind of question there is, frequently people ask me, what should I call my business? And I keep telling them, it doesn't matter. Buy a cheap bottle of wine, go into a room, write three things down. It's probably one of them is just as good as the other.
I couldn't agree with you more. When I was looking to name my company, I actually knew the editor of Adweek very, very well. And I had all these, I had Cannonball Marketing. I had really cool names, you know, that I could bring it home and my kids would think I was actually derivatively cool. And the editor of Adweek says, come here. And she goes over to her screen. This is 23 years ago. And she does a quick Google search of my name. And she said, you pop up 47 times just in Boston. Your asset is your name. Stop trying to be overly clever. Just name it your name and put your stupid ego aside. It's okay.
Which is kind of ironic since it was about naming it your name.
And I just followed the lead of the thing. But I thought it would be cool to come up with, at the end of the day, name it Shrunk, name it Blue, name it anything you want. Context is what's important. In the same way, the name of a person doesn't really matter. It's the fiber of the person that ultimately dictates. I would say to all small businesses, I would say to every large business, one bit of advice I can give you is shut the hell up and stop thinking you're the smartest person on the planet and go out, grab a cup of coffee, or in my case, a nice Earl Grey, and just watch people and watch what they do, how they do it. Watch body language. Listen to their conversations. Figure out how they actually communicate. What is the lexicon that they use to communicate with each other? And it's different, man. We think it's like multisyllabic and perfectly constructed. But, you know, and I think it's even more important right now because you and I and some of the listeners have raised a generation of children with no social skills. As a matter of fact, they're socially avoidant. They do all they can to avoid eye contact. Everything is on their phone. They can buy an instant food, instant movie, instant contact with someone around the world, never have to make eye contact, never have to take anything out of their ears. And these sons of guns, how are you going to break through and get to them?
And
observe. What
is Steve Connolly telling me how to do that? You're the brains. Tell me.
I would figure out what is important to them. So here's my analogy. And I don't know how much time you have, but this is marketing. Okay. Here's my example of marketing. Guy walks into a bar. At the end of the bar is the most beautiful girl in the world. And frankly, it could be a guy, doesn't matter. But the most beautiful girl in the world is sitting at the end of the bar. Guy walks in and there's an empty stool next to her. And she isn't just beautiful. She's the whole package. She's smart. She's got a great job. She's funny. She likes the Boston Red Sox. She has all her priorities correct in life. She is the marrying type. This is the perfect person. That is marketing, and that is your core target customer sitting there, empty stool. Your job is to go over, sit on that stool, and figure out how you're going to get a conversation going with her to the extent that you will leave with her. That is marketing. You have to figure out how you're going to get her to buy your product. And I'll go into classrooms all the time, Connell, and I'll say to this group of men and women, I'll say, every woman in this room knows what that guy is going to say when he sits on that stool. And every guy in this room is too stupid to understand that she's right. And they all look at me with two heads and I go, ladies, what is the one and only thing that guy can talk? He's only equipped to talk about one thing when he sits on that stool. And they all raise their hands and say, himself. Because that's all guys can talk about. And that's all marketers can talk about is, you know, where I went to school, how much money I weighed, how much weight can I lift, which way to the bathroom, showing off my biceps and dropping my Alfa Romeo car keys on the ground. Everything is so self-absorbed and about interest. And the guy that leaves with that girl's phone number is the guy that shuts the hell up, stares, listens, watches, tries to figure out what's important to her and how you can fill a role in her life somehow, some way, and then lie like hell and say it's important to you. And that's marketing. That's his figure out what's important to the customer by shutting up, observing and listening, and then manufacturing on your side a construction of a headline to get into her life.
But if you are making something mundane like kettles, can you really change the world in that way if you're in the kettle world?
Can I sell more kettles that way? Yeah. Of course I can. I can make you like my kettles more than anyone else's. And these days, I'll tell you another side of this is if brands don't have a purpose, if they don't find some way to articulate their soul, if they don't express, especially to a younger generation, if they don't express that something is important to them of a greater social good, then they're going to miss the opportunity to connect with this audience. So if I'm selling kettles, I'm going to sell kettles where 5% of all my sales goes to saving the blue whales. And that's all you have to do to trick these moronic young people into believing that there's actually a social conscience here. The reality is you want to find those companies that actually invest, that actually do good, and that actually advance social causes, and then people will flock to them.
I'm looking at the clock, and I have only met you about 20 minutes, but you look and sound like my long-lost brother.
Carry on. He's an ugly bastard,
Keep
Ben.
Going.
He's
Keep
an ugly
going.
Bastard.
No, I love what you're saying to me. Keep going. I won't even ask any more questions. You just give me another example. Give me some more of your learning, as they say. What else should people be doing, particularly in Ireland? As you know, the bulk of businesses are small.
I think there's many things. I think that Irish marketers and Irish clients tend to have a disproportionate appreciation for storytelling because that's inherent. And who spins a yarn like the Irish, like my, which is, I am one. But the problem is that if you have 10 people that tell beautifully crafted, wonderfully articulated stories, nothing really stands out. If you have 9 beautifully crafted, wonderfully articulated stories and 1 juggling llama, you're going to remember the juggling llama. And so it's a matter of staring at the market, seeing what other people are doing and zigging where they zag in a way that for me is based in anthropology, is based in observation of like a true human insight. Like, why, if you and I were outside in the shopping center, and I want you to explain this to me because it's undeniably true. The guys behind the glass will know this is true. If we were out in the middle of the shopping center and you turned and you kicked me in the nuts as hard as you could, and I dropped to the ground in incredible pain, everyone in the outside is going to laugh. Why is that? I'm in pain and you're a dick. Why is that? These are the things that about human nature that you have to understand and embrace. And that's real. That really happens. Why do we push elevator buttons that are already lit? Do you think it's going to make it come faster? No, but we all do it. There's these human reflexes that you see, you observe, and you build them into your experiences, be they digital or be they offline.
You are a copywriter, you told me, because I know that. Tell me some of the best copywriting strap lines and or lines that you've just seen of that you've over the years, anything fan, what would be your number one? What was your best one?
Not that I have done?
Well, either you or the one that you most admire.
Oh, there's so many that I admire. I couldn't even say one. I would say that.
Well, give me three.
We tend to go, Americans tend to judge advertising based on Super Bowl ads.
I was only reading about that is that, again, my hero in about advertising, a man called Bob Hoffman, said it made no discernible difference to sales or to website visits or anything to advertise on the Super Bowl. And yet it costs, I don't know, is it $7
million, $7
million for
30
seconds?
Yeah. So he's wrong.
No. What do you mean he's wrong? He actually did the maths on it, or as you might say, the math. Oh, Americans. The
M-A-T-H.
Mathematics. H. It's short. Mathematics. Maths. Anyway, are you saying you should do, if you had the money, Super Bowl or not? Bob Hoffman says, don't bother.
Well, it depends on the brand.
Okay.
It depends on if you have the money. It depends on if you have the distribution. It certainly doesn't make sense if you're a regional brand to do a international spot and pay an international price. But, you know, there's so many, you know, one of the biggest challenges, and I'll go off topic and then come back.
I want to bring you back to the strap line because we will run out, not the strap line, sorry, your copywriting line, your favorite one, because we will run out of time.
My favorite line of all time is just do it. I'm not a fan of the brand, but
why do you like it that much?
Because it was the most human of all lines. It basically was saying, hey, fatso, shut the hell up and just do it. Stop bitching. Stop complaining. Stop telling me why you can't and just do it. And most people won't are too young to remember, but Just Do It was originally the second half of a headline. And the original launching one was a man in a canyon running, and it was just a still. And it was beautifully shot. And the headline was, there is no finish line, just do it. And there were so many components to that that were so undeniably human. And while I clearly am not a runner, well documented, I think most runners...
You're a baseball player.
I am. Well, that's a thinking man's game. We can get into that.
No, because I have no idea how that works. And again, as usual, down that other rabbit hole, back to copywriting. That was the Nike one.
Yeah.
What was Steve Conley's best copywriting line?
The best ad I ever wrote did not have any words in it. And this was actually a campaign that launched my company to relevance, and it was for milk. And... the only copy line that was in this campaign was, the key to life is what you add to it. And it was Gorelick Farms was the name of the milk. And it's just the tagline was add something. It had nothing to do with the milk. We had done enough research with moms, and where every other milk provider is saying, well, it has calcium and it has this comes in a light block bottle and preserves longer. It's like the women that we met in the research looked at me and they said, do you think I'm some sort of an idiot that I don't know that there's calcium in milk, that it's good for my kids, that it's good for bones? It's been hardwired into my system. But what I did is my partner and I would show milk in a context that women would identify with and want to see, a father and a son eating cereal, and then they finish the milk off with a crazy straw. Simple moments in life where milk was present. We took 6 share points from the market leader at that time. We did it with half of the budget, and it was a campaign that went on for years. So that was the line was add something, which lacks context. And of course, now you're saying, seriously, that's it? Those 2 words?
But- no, I am always fascinated by what sells things. And like, as you say, with Nike, just do it. Mm. And it sticks in that. You just said, just do it. And the tick came into my head immediately. Mm-hmm. So powerful.
Well, I think, and the other one that everyone always mentions that everyone knows globally is Think Different for Apple, which is grammatically incorrect. And they were castigated right at the beginning because that's not proper English.
An American talking about grammar.
Yeah, and stuff and junk.
Come here to me. Final question we always ask all our guests is, who would Steve Conley hire in a heartbeat?
Well, there's so many people that I would hire. I'll tell you one, there's an opening at my company right now for me from 25 years ago, which is a writer with a appreciation for observation and wants to work hard and wants to explore and wants to try some things. I'm looking for copywriters. I think
I'm looking for a name,
a specific name,
a specific person, be that Steve Jobs, be that Mother Mary Teresa.
Jerry Seinfeld.
Okay. Why?
Master observationalist, never swore, never contorted himself, never really took himself too seriously. He had the ability to look at life, pull moments out of it, and he became the signature comic of this generation.
Never swore. How long have you been in Ireland? Your new team and your old team, like, we pepper everything with swearing.
I'm aware of this.
Yeah.
I know all the words.
But you don't approve.
I didn't say that either, but I think
you seem to like it because you mentioned it about
Mr.
Seinfeld.
I think some people, like some advertisers, they believe there has to be a gimmick. You need to contort your body. You need to raise your voice. You need to bring up your ethnicity. You need to jump around. You need to do something. And the guy, Seinfeld, he would put a stool down, and I've seen him live multiple times. He'll put a stool down. He'll tell you what he saw today. That's all. And you will laugh your ass off. And you'll think, I should pay more money to see this guy again.
Are you familiar with Billy Connolly?
Oh, yes, I am.
One of their swearing plus the stool, yeah, plus what he saw today.
It's spelled with an O. I can't spell Connolly with an O. It's spelled with an E.
Brian, please, First of all, welcome to Team GBS, because you're now a player for Team GBS. Please come back next time, because you will be back. Actually, final question. I always ask final questions. Are you done buying agencies here?
I will never say never. I'd say right now we have some work to do with what we've got.
Okay.
But no, I'd never say never. I mean, how much is this studio? Maybe we'll buy this show.
Very welcome.
And if we do, I will not disclose terms.
Okay. Steve Connolly, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thanks, Colin, for having me.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural De Facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRedCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRedCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
That Great Business Show.
You, our lovely listeners, know how much we hate acronyms. However, for the next item, I'm asking for your indulgence as I make an exception. That's because for the next while, we'll be talking about the Research Institute for Design Engineering, Artificial Intelligence and Advanced Manufacturing. And I'm not going to keep calling it all of those names. So instead, we're talking about IDM and about the whole business of clusters, particularly business clusters. Regular listeners will also know we love a good doctor. And when we have one of those joining us now, he is a doctor who has travelled from Limerick to join us to talk about your business and how it can benefit directly from his beloved clusters. He is Dr. Jamie Meehan, Educational and Outreach Manager at the IDM Research Institute at Limerick Institute of Technology. Jamie Meehan, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks very much for having me on, Conal.
Am I saying it right? IDM, or do you call it IDM, or...
IDM cluster.
Clusters. We've had an item back probably 6 months, maybe 9 months ago, about clusters. It is, one, a great idea. Two, fascinating. Three, only in its infancy. Discuss.
I don't know if we have enough time in 20 minutes to discuss this topic, but the whole cluster concept has been around for decades. If you go back to the 1940s in the Basque cluster policy in the Spanish region, but from an Irish perspective, it's only been in terms of its baby stages.
I would phew, so it is infancy.
It is infancy.
I thought you were going to call me out for being wrong about it.
No,
okay.
You'd be correct in saying that. But if you go back to 1992, it was the kind of first main report from an Irish context, the Cullerton report. That's over 30 years ago. And only now we're having the national cluster policy being implemented by Grant Thornton. So it's taken that time. But there's a lot happening in the cluster space at the moment in Ireland.
And why clusters? What's good about clusters? Sell me clusters.
Okay. In a nutshell, it's about connecting people, connecting communities, but bringing businesses together to start working together so that they can compete, but also work collaboratively.
Examples, please.
Okay. So I'm the cluster manager of IDEUM. So we support manufacturing SMEs with their business growth through digitalization. So to give you some examples of what we do, some of our companies, to give you an example, like Total Precision and Gradon Computers, are now working together to improve their digitalization of the manufacturing processes. And that wasn't done before the connection with IDEUM.
So how does, we have many, many thousands of SMEs listening to this podcast. What's in it for them and how do they get involved with a cluster?
Okay. So how you get involved is by signing up as a member. But the value proposition is very, very important. We're only a year in terms of when we launched IDEUM back in April of last year. So the value proposition for our members is around talent and skills, research and development, internationalization and funding, and the business and community development side of the cluster. So in a nutshell, why would an SME get involved? It's about doing more with less, that you have more reach and more potential and more opportunities.
But from what you're saying to me, and I'm only just listening to you, it sounds like they, the SMEs, have to get one, very involved, but also do a lot of work?
No. So the cluster itself has a cluster manager. and it's a cluster organization. So it's a full-time person working to support the company. Just to give you an example, Colin, before I flew up here to Dublin today from Limerick, in the treacherous weather that we're having at the moment, I was with one of our members, Action Point, and we're doing a digitalization workshop next week, next Friday from 10 till 12:30. And we're bringing together members to start working together. So it's about bringing them together to start looking at opportunities that they wouldn't have had without being part of the cluster.
One of the items that I remember talking about before when we were discussing clusters was that in business, we all love each other in business, of course, until you eat my lunch. And when you are clustering with like-minded, like-type businesses who could be eating your lunch.
Well, I think maybe in an Irish context, that might be true in some respects. But if you're looking global and international, I think it's more valuable to be part of a cluster organization and the cooperation concept of competing and collaborating and going abroad. And it's, you definitely have more competitiveness if you're part of that type of grouping. But look, I take it on board. It's been said to me by some cluster members, but without working together, then how do you learn and how do you grow?
So how do you get over it?
You bring them together and you're kind of just talking about what's in it for them. How do they get involved in the cluster and how do they start working together as well?
If I read my brief notes that you sent very kindly, thank you, correctly, there's money in this as well.
Correct. So since we launched Ideum, over €300,000 has been won in terms of projects. Just to give you one example, 2 weeks ago, we were successful in an Erasmus Plus program, where we're linking in with clusters in Slovenia and Spain, and their members now are going to start working together with Ideum members.
Well, hang on a second. You've gone from maybe clustering in Munster.
Correct.
To clustering across Europe.
Yes.
How does that work?
So a big thing as part of my research was to look at what's happening outside of Ireland. So I went to countries like Finland, Spain, India, Chile to explore what type of clustering opportunities are there. And I think as a cluster manager, it's very important that you're looking outwards and that you're forward thinking and you're doing that for your members. So a part of my job is looking at cluster to cluster exchanges across Europe and a part of the European Cluster Acceleration Program. And then we start working on projects together to help members. And then they start working and sharing ideas together and then going after business together.
If you are clustering in your head, in one's head, you're thinking that you're going to outsmart the opposition. Where do you see the opposition in the areas that you're trying to cluster in? Do you follow me?
Define what you mean by opposition. As in different clusters?
Different manufacturers or different, just people who will compete with you in business.
Okay. If I understand the question correctly, I see it from a point of view of that they're, yes, they compete. They're all going after maybe the same egg in some respects. But by being part of Ideum, and this is a really, really important part, is that we're looking outwards. So for instance, one of our members, Kroon Precision Medical, we went to Brussels 2 weeks ago, and now they're going to be part of the Galactica project, where they're going to start doing projects with companies potentially in Portugal and then looking at new business opportunities.
I love this stuff because you obviously carry it around in your head. The Galactica project.
Galactica project. So it's EU Horizon 2020 project to cross collaboration and new value chains in advanced manufacturing, aerospace and textile sectors.
There seems to be a whole world out there with that is financed as well, that opens up like a hidden treasure for businesses. And you seem to know where it's out.
Is there a question?
tell me, how do you find out about it? Are there other cluster managers that people can go to? Must they go to Limerick? Or could you have one in Louth or in Donegal?
So clusters need to be built on regional strengths. So what are we actually good at? Okay, we're not going to replicate the models like Silicon Valley and these kind of high potential startups in terms of Google, Yahoo, and all these multinational companies, but it's to look at what we're good at and build around that. And that's the bottom-up clustering approach. But to go back to your question, how do I know about these EU funding and these grants? Before I took on this cluster manager role, I was an EU grants manager based down in CIT at the time, now Munster Technological University, and was involved in these type of European projects. And a big part of my remit when I started Ideum was to get companies, particularly startups and SMEs, involved in EU funding projects.
I imagine, and that's always a bad start, is that there is a ton, now I mean lots and lots of money available for this kind of work, only if you know where it is.
Mm. Correct. And I think that's one of the big barriers for companies, is that they're so busy with their day-to-day activities, is like, what's outside the box? And being part of IDEUM is where we come in and help companies demystify what's out there, not just in Europe, but also in Ireland, in terms of the opportunities, funding. But it's not just funding, it's talent initiatives and research opportunities, both on the island of Ireland and outside.
What does talent initiative mean?
So talent means, how do we get companies to think and change a bit differently in terms of their cultures? So for instance, tonight we have the Leadership in Digitalization and Manufacturing course. It's Springboard funded, run with the Technological University of the Shannon in the Midwest, where we get companies together and they learn about digitalization. So what is it and how do I actually do it properly? So there's all these lovely acronyms of Industry 4 and Industry 5, but what does that actually mean in practice for my company?
Oh, I thought that was you were going to explain.
It's a rhetorical question, right? But and then these companies learn about digital maturity. Okay, they start doing digital readiness assessments. So to look within and what can they do in terms of digitalization. So for instance, instead of benchmarking off what other companies are doing, what can we do with what we have and what does it actually mean?
Have you seen anything absolutely transformative in clustering?
Yes. So if you look at the Siaga automotive cluster in Galicia, it's a phenomenal engine. Okay, there's over 90 employees. And it's based beside the Peugeot and Citroën base in Galicia near Vigo. And it's just a phenomenal engine for companies to be involved in. You should see it for yourself.
But tell me about it, because I presume I won't get to see it.
Okay. So in Europe, Conal, you have what's called the ECSA, which is the cluster labeling system. So it goes from gold, silver to bronze. Siaga would be classified as a gold label cluster, meaning they have X amount of number of members, but they're also supporting them and growing the cluster. And it's not just a public funded entity, but it's also privately funded.
And what has Siaga, if I'm saying it correctly, delivered for its members?
Projects. It's got them involved in projects cooperatively together, but also involved in EU projects.
And has it brought them into the automobile sector in a big way? And has it delivered the old euro profit?
Correct. I don't know the profit statistics off the top of my head. You'll find that online. But it's brought companies together that mightn't have worked together before. I think that's a big remit as part of a cluster, is to look outside and not inward. And getting companies on a table to talk to each other that mightn't have done so before.
And must a company, because a company listening to this podcast might say, God, that's really interesting. Must they be based in and around the Midwest or down Limerick way or?
Okay. So IDEUM is funded under the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment with Enterprise Ireland. It's called the Regional Technology Clustering Fund. So it's a period of 3 years, but it needs then to become sustainable after those 3 years. IDEUM is a national cluster, but with a lens on the Midwest. So no is the answer. I have members that are involved across the island of Ireland. And the rationale for that is manufacturing space is quite small in Ireland. And I think others want to be part of what we're trying to build.
So what kind of companies would you like to attract in, more companies that you want to attract in to your IDEUM?
Okay. So we have 97 SMEs at the moment. So it's quite large.
For size? SMEs, would there be two person and up to 200 or what kind of size?
It varies. So you'd have startups, micro enterprises, SMEs, medium and large.
Everything, the usual.
Everything, okay.
What's the overarching thing that they're doing? Is it, what kind of manufacturing?
So precision engineering for the medtech and the aviation sector. So they'd be building components for these type of companies like Bombardier, and then medical device companies as well.
So when they cluster together, and we'll take Bombardier because we know that brand name, do you knock on the door and say, listen, lads, we have this capability down across Ireland, but particularly down in the Midwest. What can we do for you? Or do you go to them and say, we could do this for you?
So initially, for the first 4 months in the inauguration stage of IDEUM, was a kind of a needs analysis. So to kind of tell people about the cluster and to see what they wanted from it. So we've built the cluster around the needs of what the companies wanted. To go back to your question, is yes, it was door to door. Obviously, with COVID, it was phone to phone and online meetings. But now it's going to site visits and telling people about IDEAM. And if they want to join, here's what's part of it and why you would become part of the cluster.
And what is the process? What would they have to do? In particular, does it cost money?
Okay, so right now, for the first year, it was being open and collaborative. But this year, the membership model is coming into effect. So right now, we're in the development stages of how we're going to do the membership model for the companies that are involved in IDEAM. And maybe, Conal, the 97 SMEs that we have currently, some are really active and some aren't. And so, unfortunately, that's just part of business. What's going to happen, I believe, and this is from my experience of looking at clusters across Europe, is that you'll have a core group after you bring in the membership model because they really value what you're trying to do. And others then will start to understand, if we're part of this, this is what can happen.
What do we do wrong with clustering in Ireland?
At the moment, I think there's a lot of noise in Ireland around clusters, networks, incubators, accelerators, science packs, and there's a lot of confusion. So hopefully with this national cluster policy being implemented, it'll demystify and break down some of those barriers and acronyms, because companies, they're so busy. All they want to see is, if I'm part of this, do I get value of it?
And of course.
And that's,
yeah.
Exactly. And that's what they want.
And that's why we're an acronym-free zone as well, because you're trying to figure out, now what's in this for me?
Correct. Yeah.
And so what do people need to do to get involved with you?
Okay. So go to www.ideum.ie.
I laugh every time anybody says W, because nobody's ever said XXX or YYY.
I know. It's part of the lingo. The internet generation. And sign up. So we have a sign up form. Fill in your details. Your logo goes on the website. You become part of the community. And then all of the activities that we're doing, you get offers and you become part of the different activities that we're rolling out.
And a bit like a club member, do you have to actively be to participate, or can you dip in and say, God, yeah, that looks really interesting, I could do a bit of that?
Mm. It's up to the company. Okay.
Yeah.
How much the company puts in, the more they get out. What I've seen is the more I engage with companies and the more they engage with me, the higher level of value they get out of IDEAM. So for instance, to give an example, like the workshops that we're going to be doing next week, a lot of the people that are going to be at that workshop are the active members of IDEAM because they've really engaged and they want to learn and they're continuously innovating. And then they get involved in the EU projects that we're going to be rolling out. So like the Change to Twin, I don't know if you've heard of this, Colin.
Nope.
So it's another EU funding I4MS initiative. But it's the digital readiness of companies. So three of our members got €10,000 to look at where they need to go next in terms of digitalization. One of our companies was just recently funded the deployment voucher within Change to Twin at €90,000 to look at the digital twinning of their manufacturing processes.
That's all right.
It's not too bad. It's not too shabby.
€90,000.
€90,000.
And who's paying that?
So it's part of the European Commission initiative I4MS. It's very competitive, I'm not going to lie. Having insight and having a very good team to disseminate these type of applications and support the applications with our members does help. But they have to have a clear and novel idea on where they're going. But it is competitive.
And competitive also is, it's not quite an acronym, but it is shorthand for sure, for many pages to fill out.
Depends on the
funding
mechanism.
I've been told by people that like you can run into hundreds of pages, is that true?
No, so like the Orbital 100K funding mechanism through Galactica is 10 pages.
Okay, right?
Okay.
That's easy.
Well, I wouldn't say easy, but definitely
10 is doable.
It's manageable. The Pioneer project of €20,000 is 5 pages. And then if you look at the digitalization voucher initiative that Enterprise Ireland rolled out last year up until June 2022 this year, I believe, it'll probably be scaled out, is a €9,000 voucher to look at the digital readiness of your company as well. And that application is quite lean as well, in fairness. So look, I think the application process probably deters a lot of the companies away from this. And that's something I'm trying to break down. And get companies to understand, look, you should be involved in these applications. There's money there, not willy-nilly, but if you get involved in them, it might make you just think and change a bit differently.
It's not just about the money either.
It's
of course,
not.
It's money is towards something.
Money is only a small part of it.
And it's a grant, isn't it? So therefore, no taxes or anything else. This is actual spending money.
Correct. And the digitalization voucher is 100% funded, so there's no payback for the company in terms of actually being a grant. Because some schemes in Europe, for instance, might be 80 to 20%. Meaning that you're only going to draw down 80% of the funding, and some other bits need to be subcontracted to various experts.
But in terms of the funding of the digitalization, is that coming from the Irish government, from Enterprise Ireland, or from Europe?
So the digitalization voucher comes from the Irish government.
Okay.
And it was rolled out last summer. So we've had 14 companies that are now digital advisors. So basically, any company that's looking at the digitalization voucher can select 14 of our IDEA members to work with the digitalization voucher on.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Now, what about the take-up of this? Because now I know it's a completely different world. It's probably not even apples and oranges. But you know, the Leo give you is a €2,500 just to get you online. Mm. And the pick-up on that, bizarrely, hasn't been huge. It's been okay. But instead of being 100%, it's not 100%. In terms of digitalization, where you probably have more serious companies, what are you seeing there in terms of take-up?
Take-up has been quite good, especially with the digitalization voucher. I spoke with John Durkin, the head of digital transformation in Enterprise Ireland, who's rolling out this initiative, and applications are flying in. I think because a lot of promotion has gone behind it as well at a national level, and then being disseminated through the clusters to the members. So there's been a high level of take-up of that voucher, particularly to call. I just think if any SME is listening in particular, or any startup, or any entrepreneur, or potential entrepreneur, just think about it from the point of view of what can we actually do? Like, digitalization means so many different things to different companies. But with the basics, if you have a machine shop, say you have 10 machines, what digitalization do you need? Like, the data coming off those machines, what does that actually mean for your company and the people on the floor? A culture change is so important. It can't just be the decision makers. It has to be a unified approach.
And you can do that for them.
We will support and help with it, but it's up to the companies to take that.
You're not going to get initiative. Your hands dirty with the machines, no.
Look, we go out and we do site visits, so we do get our hands dirty. But at the end of the day, look, IDEUM is an engine to support the growth of companies. We're very open. But for me, the foundation of IDEUM is also always based on trust. It's the biggest value. People by people, and in Ireland, that's very, very prevalent. So, and that's very much part of what we're trying to build.
And it is all based in LIT, Limerick Institute of Technology, but has that become the Munster?
So, LIT, Limerick Institute of Technology, amalgamated it with Athlone Institute of Technology, and is now recognized as the new Technological University of the Shannon.
Oh, that's it.
Midlands, okay. Midwest.
Okay. I knew there was another acronym. I'm sure that's called MUDSUD or something okay. like that, is it?
No, Midlands, Midwest. So, look, it's a brilliant initiative because it brings the two colleges together more, and we're working on projects collaboratively more as well.
The final question, you know what it is.
Go on.
Who would Jimmy Meehan even, I was going to say Jimmy Heaslip, he used to present with me, did. If you remember, yeah.
I'm not that big.
Who would Jamie Meehan hire in a heartbeat?
Tomorrow morning, I would hire a gentleman called Simon Sinek. I don't know if you've ever read any of his books. So Start With Why.
I do.
Infinite Game. Yeah.
I was going to say, I know of him. Have I read? No, but okay. You obviously have and you love him.
Love him is probably a bit fair. I love my family. No, he's brilliant. And the reason is, Colin, he got me thinking a bit differently. Like, always start with a why, with a purpose. Why do we actually get up out of bed in the morning? Why are we doing this? And why are we helping companies? And I think if you start with that versus what are we doing, it's very, very important. And the cultural change and the mindset change in terms of digitalization, I believe starting with the why is really important.
See, that's what you get. You have big ideas on That Great Business Show. And that big idea that is just heard there was brought to you by Jamie Meehan, Dr. Jamie Meehan. The doctorate was for?
Clusters and Regional Development.
That's amazing.
Thank you very much.
Jamie, congratulations on your doctorate, which you got last year and which you still need to celebrate properly. And these great insights are always brought to you by our sponsor, De Facto Shave. the best shaving oil in the world.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms, or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRedCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy to use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRedCloud.com, 100% Irish owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Subscribe today to That Great Business Show on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple and Spotify.
Just sign here. That's the instruction you're given when you're buying or selling or simply booking into a hotel room. It seems almost quaint that simply writing your name or marking with an X or even possibly a thumbprint could have serious legal implications for your business and your money, particularly now in a digital or DocuSign age. We've had a wonderful reaction to our occasional legal advice slot that we only introduced very recently, so we decided to do it again. We asked our in-house legal counsel, barrister, and presenter of the Law on Trial podcast, Peter Leonard, to join us once again, this time to talk about signatures. Peter Leonard, welcome to That Great Business Show.
It's good to be back, Cuddle. It's good to be back. Yes. Signatures. Okay.
We still use them, which is kind of bizarre. Yeah, absolutely. Am I right in saying, am I old enough to remember, did President Clinton come over here once upon a time, about 20 years ago, maybe more?
Okay.
And there was something that he did about digital signature. We were going to adopt digital signatures.
Well, so for that would fit with the timescale, because I think President Clinton was there in 1992 to 2000.
And it was around 2000
He
did this.
Yeah. Yes, that's
and
right.
And he did, or whatever one does, the first digital signature, I think.
Yes, well, that could well be the case. And that would make sense around 1998 when, you know, he was distracted with other matters. He was still thinking about digital signatures, which is really, really cool.
But the law was
his colleagues in the European Union, they brought in a directive in 1999 in relation to electronic signatures. And we in Ireland, of course, being kind of up to speed with everything, we brought in the Electronic Commerce Act of 2000, I think. I'm not an expert in this, Cunnell, but that allowed...
I'm very impressed you're not using any notes. This
no,
is all
not
coming
using
out
any
back
notes.
Of the head.
And I don't even have a cigarette package. But anyway, so in 2000 that came in, and that effectively paved the way for electronic documents and electronic signatures, and that if a document is sent to somebody, like if I send you an email, Cunnell, saying I'm giving you all my money, and you know, you engage, and that can be proven, and that I intended to do that when I sent to you, it could be a valid contract. And it might not be, but it could be, if you know what I mean. So you have to tie down all these things.
But hang on a second, it could be or might be or would be. That's a beautiful thing for you lawyers. You love that, because of course that goes into the courts. When does it become? I send you an email.
Yes.
Peter, you have bought my car. Send on 10,000 quid. Now, isn't it? Offer, acceptance,
offer
and consideration.
Offer and acceptance, yes.
And consideration.
And that's it. It's a binding contract. You're right.
So
but
does
the point
is... my signature on the email that I've just sent you, is that good enough?
That is good. Well, is it good enough? Yes, it is. It probably is good enough. But what happens, Cunnell, if you say to me, oh, I never sent you that email at all. Oh, did it come from my account? Or somebody else must have sent that. So there you go. So therefore, you have to determine whether the person actually sent it. So that's why a signature is so much easier. Now, in Britain at the moment, they accept digital signatures. You just type in your name on an email, and if it's accepted by the other party, that has been found in various different cases there, I believe, to be acceptable and to give evidence to a binding contract. In Ireland, it probably does as well, because we have this Act from 2000. Then we had a further European directive in the mid-teens, I think 2015, 2016, the EDAS regulation, I think, which was brought in by the European Union, which gave further effect to this and basically said that for international business, that an electronic signature is good enough. It is good enough and it is a binding contract. But we Irish, we like to see pen and ink on the page.
A quill.
Just to be sure. A quill is fine. A quill is fine. Or a thumbprint or whatever.
Now, actually, there's a question. I did say it in my intro there about an X or a thumbprint. Does that have any legal binding at all?
Absolutely. But what it is
get
absolutely.
Away. I only put that in because, well, I just thought about it, but it doesn't really.
Yeah, but you have to speak to it as well, if you know what I mean. So it doesn't in itself. Okay, so somebody puts an X.
I'll speak it to my thumb now.
Yeah. But if you see an X on the bottom of a page, that could be the mark made by somebody who is assenting to what that document is, committing to, you know, a contract or saying, I approve of the document I've just signed. So that X is entirely valid. I mean, look at the signatures people have. They're like dreadful. Do you know what I mean? Famous doctor's prescriptions, you know, try and make out the name. It's very hard. So if somebody puts an X there, but if it's an X, it has to be attested to somebody who is a witness. So the witness, there has to be a witness, a second party there to say, I saw John, I saw Mary putting an X at the bottom of that page and I'm going to prove it. So the
signed,
X is valid.
Signed
the X
y.
Is valid. So signed Y. Signed Y. You know, so that's it, you know.
And the thumbprint? The old
fashioned thumbprint would be fine. I mean, again, it's a mark. It's a mark. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to have beautiful writing, you know, and beautiful joined up writing that I'm sure the nuns or the Christian Brothers taught you all those years ago. You don't have to have that. You just need to put a mark down, and the mark has to be your assent to give effect to what you're signing.
Now, I'm going off on my usual little tangents here. A signet ring. Do you remember the fancy people? You don't have one.
Like the cardinal or something, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the bishop.
But
the bishop.
If you go to the City of London.
Yes.
All the posh people in the city have a little signet ring. Did you know that?
Yes. So, well, I didn't really, to tell you the truth, but I can believe that.
You just
might,
watch
you
their know. Little pinky and they have one. That's a real posh sign.
Yeah, well, that might be their mark or something, and they could put their mark down.
Would it be? So it would be, say, the Ormoran Crescent or something like that, and I just stamp it, yeah?
Yeah, but it has to, like, I mean, at the end of the day, somebody has to be able to attest that that is the person signing it. So if it is your specific signature, or if you put your stamp, and in the good old days, they used to put a seal in wax. I mean, that would all work.
Well, that's what I mean by the signature.
That would all work. You know, but it has to be, if it is challenged, you have to say, yes, that is my mark, and that will be accepted then.
Yeah, but that kind of almost negates the first one because somebody else has gone and...
But it's like all these things. There isn't a problem until there is a problem.
All right.
That's it.
Now, one of the areas where there is or can be a problem, forgery.
Yes, forgery.
People do forge.
Yes, they do forge. Yes, they do forge. And allegations of forgery and then people saying that, you know, I've been a victim as a result of forgery. We know historically, go back to our great, to Charles Stewart Parnell, the famous Pigot forgeries, and he won that case. At the same time, across the water in France, we know the Dreyfus affair, where Alfred Dreyfus lost his career and was penalised, sent to Devil's Island as a result of forgeries, and that led to a hold and anti-Semitism and everything in France. It was crazy, but that was based on forgeries, etc.
Roger Casement,
absolutely.
And then,
so the Black Diaries were authenticated, I think, afterwards, weren't they?
Kind of were, I think.
Okay.
Most recently,
I don't know.
Most recently, people are saying...
As a lawyer, I should pull back from making a commitment, but anyway.
The most recent one in terms of politics here, though, was very interesting. Pontius de Rossa.
Yes, Pontius de Rossa, the great Pontius de Rossa, former leader of Democratic Left. He was a former MEP for the Labour Party. And we know he was a minister in the government, the famous Rainbow government in the mid-1990s. But before all that, he was leader of the Workers' Party. Do you remember the Workers' Party, Connell?
I certainly do.
And in 1986, the Workers' Party were deemed to have sent a letter to Moscow, the famous Moscow letter. And that was to the old USSR, as Paul McCartney used to call it, and to the USSR Communist Party. And I think that was in the era of Brezhnev, just when Gorbachev was coming in. And the Workers' Party were deemed to be looking for funds. And the letter was purportedly signed by Sean Garland. I don't think he had any problem with saying he signed the letter. But there was also another signature on the letter, and it was deemed to be that of Pontius de Rossa. So another gentleman who was well known in the 1990s called Eamon Dunphy. Did you ever hear of him? He wrote an article about Pontius de Rossa in the mid-90s, and he made reference to this letter.
Oh, what did he say? There was a good signature, not a great signature.
Yes, it's not a great signature. But anyway, he as a result, there was a libel action, and an issue emerged as to whether Pontius de Rossa had actually signed the letter. And he said, no, I did not sign it. So the question was, both sides had to bring in handwriting evidence. So independent newspapers who were defending the case against Mr. De Rossa brought in a retired guard who was an expert in this. And he went over and he saw the original document, I think, in Moscow. And he looked through it and he went through the whole thing. And he said, I've seen loads of examples of Pontius de Rossa's writing. And I can say that this is his signature. But on the other side, Mr. de Rossa brought in an expert, a fellow called Mr. Ansell, Michael Ansell, I think was his name, who was an international expert. And he looked at 217 documents that had been signed by Pontius de Rossa. And he matched that with the signature on the page. And when he looked at it, he said, there's a problem with the D on the de Rossa. Okay, so that was it. So that seemed to be the focal point. And he also spotted other idiosyncrasies in the signature. So he was cross-examined by, I think, Patrick McEntee, who was the barrister for the independent newspapers. And they got into wonderful discussions about the fluency of the writing, the flow. Was there any unexpected uplifts of pen? This was it, you know. And in the end, I'm not sure exactly what they said in relation to the signature. I think one expert kind of negated the other. Ultimately, it was a successful day for Pontius de Rossa. I think he was awarded 300,000 by the jury in that case.
Whoa,
so there you go. So that was it.
And
you know?
Do remind listeners that court awards are tax-free.
Tax-free, yeah, into your pocket.
So
absolutely.
That's the equivalent of 600,000 old pounds by whatever.
In the good old days, 1997, that was a lot of money, wasn't it?
You know, a vast amount of money. Yeah.
But there have been a lot of cases. There was one well-known case in the UK recently, in the last couple of years, very sad case, and it was to do with a fertility clinic and a couple who went for fertility treatment, and they had one child, embryos were frozen, etc., and they had one child after an embryo was unfrozen. Sadly, the relationship broke down and there were more embryos that had been stored with the fertility company. That's Hammersmith IVF, ARB versus Hammersmith IVF. And the relationship broke down. The wife decided that she wanted to have another baby and she forged the signature of her ex-partner on a consent to thaw form, consent to thaw. I better pronounce my THs there. And that was it. So she proceeded to it and a healthy baby was born, which is a wonderful thing. And the male partner then sued the fertility clinic on the basis that he never gave his consent. The fertility clinic were only allowed to proceed to an IVF, an in vitro fertilization process, with his consent, the consent of both parties. And he said, I did not consent to this. So first of all, they had to decide, well, you've got a signature in the bottom of the page. Did you sign this document? He said, no, I did not. So they brought in handwriting experts and the handwriting experts had a look and they weren't sure, but there was some suggestion that the flow wasn't spot on and that there was, you know, unexpected uplifts of pens.
I'm getting good at this, yeah.
But the giveaway was they brought in, when they couldn't figure it out, they brought in the ultraviolet light. So they shone this on the signature and lo and behold, underneath the signature, they found graphite marks, which were sort of the tracings of a pencil. So they believed that the signature had been initially traced in pencil and then written over in pen. And that explained the unexpected uplifts in the pen, etc. So it's a very sad story. And I mean, I'm making a joke out of it. But and in that case, the male partner was suing the fertility clinic because because he now had a healthy child that he was responsible for. And ultimately, the case resolved that it was, you know, that he had a claim, but that he had no claim in damages because you can't claim for a healthy baby, which is deemed to be a blessing. Isn't that a wonderful thing?
That's a nice twist.
And so while he at law had established that liability lay with the clinic and lay, I suppose, with his ex-partner, it wasn't worth anything to him because he was deemed to have a blessing rather than a liability over the years.
Any other weird or wonderful?
Another famous case. Did you ever hear of a fella called Thomas Slab Murphy?
Oh, I did too.
A leading Republican, okay. Well-known man from Haxball's Cross in County Louth. Or was he from Haxball's Cross in County Louth? Because his farm, I remember half his farm was in South Armagh, wasn't that it?
It was half the building.
Yeah, had the shed. It? Half the shed was in. So when he went into the shed, if he stepped this way, he was in a different jurisdiction.
And amazingly, things were able to cross that border without...
there you go.
What was his case?
So his case concerned, as we know, he was a leading Republican or alleged to be a leading Republican, et cetera, et cetera. And, I suppose he was famous for that involvement. And he famously took a case against the Sunday Times, claiming that it was his other brother who was known as Slab Murphy as well. So Slab was a family name in the best tradition of Irish names, where the Slab came in. There was 11 brothers, I think. And so he deemed that this was to do with his other brother, but he didn't succeed in that claim. But in this claim, the state came after him for tax evasion. And it was to do with, and I don't know a lot about this, but it was to do with sort of agricultural grants and EU aid and heritage payments or something. I'm not 100% sure. So he had to sign all these documents. So he brought in a witness to say, I didn't sign those documents. And the signatures were all of T. Murphy. That was it. And so he brought in an expert, and the expert deemed some of them not to have been signed by him, but acknowledged that some of them from earlier years had been signed by him. Anyway, the net result was this issue came before the court, special criminal court, of course, and then went before the Court of Appeal on appeal. And the court found that while it accepted to a certain extent the handwriting evidence, it found that there were other factors. And poor old Thomas Slab Murphy ended up getting 18 months in jail for tax evasion.
If one wants to be on the right side of the law, do the right thing, and make sure that you're not legged, as that great legal term goes, what's the best way of signing and making sure a document is properly signed forever and a day?
Well, the way to do it is to sign it, and sign it in the presence of your solicitor, or else sign it in the presence of a witness who will attest to the signature. So therefore, if there's any question mark about the signature, you have the witness who will attest to it and also sign the document. But the best thing is to do it in front of your solicitor.
Solicitors, like the rest of us, go to the great courtroom in the sky.
Yes,
and
they
what
do.
Happens
yes,
when
they do.
You're,
can you believe it? Yes.
Like when your solicitor is missing.
Well, if your solicitor is missing...
permanently missing.
Permanently missing. Okay, well, then maybe you could get a different solicitor.
No, I mean that you've signed and it's Jay Smith and he is your solicitor and Jay Smith dies.
Okay.
Who attests them?
Well, the document itself will be... So take, for example, like, you know, the obvious case is a will, okay? And under Section 78, I think it is, of the Succession Act, a will must be signed by the testator, that's the person who's making the will, at the foot of the page, but it must also be attested by two witnesses. Okay. So it must be signed in the presence of two other individuals. So the hope is that the person who is the testator will not have survived if the will is being read. I mean, I think there's a logic to that position. But the two witnesses will survive and somebody, you know, executors can attest to the fact that it's a valid will. And of course, there's only a problem, as I said earlier, Connell,
when
there is a problem.
Okay, two final questions, three
yes.
final questions maybe.
Yes.
One of them is, and this is maybe a bit unpleasant to ask, if you are not capable of writing a signature, i.e., say that you're paralyzed or
yes.
whatever, what do you do?
Well, you can make a mark. So for example, somebody who hasn't the capacity to write maybe yeah. can touch a document with ink with part of their body and say that is the mark. Again, it has to be attested by
okay.
somebody else. Or also you can deem somebody to be a proxy to sign a document for you.
Of course, yeah.
That's not my area of expertise. I don't really know because that's more for solicitors. They sign all these documents in secret offices. I don't. But that would be a way of attesting and verifying that a document was signed. For example, if somebody is blind and maybe yeah. doesn't sign a document, they can come in and there is a way of doing it and somebody can attest to the fact that they were present, they assented to what was ever stated on the document.
I wonder what's going to happen, and this is kind of a question, what will happen in the future when none of us can handwrite, everything is digital?
Well, that's what this e-commerce act is all about. Now, I don't think it has been tested in the courts that much, you know, but I mean, there will be very important documents. There is a way of creating an electronic verification system. I mean, that's all way beyond my pay grade. I don't really know about
DocuSign,
that.
DocuSign, and it's being used now.
Yes.
So that is the future. But yeah, I suppose that's just the way it'll be. Yeah.
But I think most people, if you're kind of borrowing the money for a plot of land or for the 3-bedroomed house, you really want to put your signature at the bottom of the page, you know, don't you? You don't really want some email floating around there in cyberspace.
Sent by fax. So you probably use a fax as well, do you?
No, Snail. I have a pigeon that flies in and brings the letters off to people. No, we have to move with the times. We're a bit slow in the law to move with the times. We like the old-fashioned practices, you know. But the old-fashioned practices have served us well. You know, maybe our clients mightn't say that, but I think they have served us well. So we're fans of that.
This is only the second time you've been on That Great Business Show.
Yes.
But there is this tradition.
Will there be a third, though, Cuddle?
Oh, there will, of course. You make me smile, of course. Anybody who makes me smile comes back. The last question we ask everybody, as you know, who would Peter Leonard, BL, hire in a heartbeat?
Well, that's a brilliant question. And I was delighted the last time to mention David Boies. And wasn't I right?
Yes, you were.
That settlement that was agreed for Virginia Giuffre against Prince Andrew. Wow, so he did a good job there. I'm torn on this occasion, Cuddle. I have two people that I want to nominate.
Okay.
The first is the Duffer himself, Damien Duff. And I want to say big shout out to Damien Duff. He has just taken charge for his first League of Ireland match last week, Shelburne. So this is a guy who won two Premier Leagues with Chelsea, Jose Mourinho. And now he's back in Talca Park, not exactly the San Siro, I have to say. And he's doing his bit for the League of Ireland. And I think it shows a bit of humility. It shows a bit of, he's a genuine guy. He wants to prove himself at this level. And I really respect that. And I love that. And that's leadership. So therefore, I'd hire him in a heartbeat.
Before you go on, do we smell a Shell supporter?
No, not necessarily. No, from a distance. Though I am a Rathfarnham lad, and we're very proud of Damien Duff and Rathfarnham. So there you go. But I just think it's great that somebody of his status, and I mean, I'm not a big League of Ireland fan, though I really respect it, and I always think League of Ireland fans are so genuine, and that's why they're so excited to have Damien Duff in their ranks at the moment. And there seems to have been a full house, all of 4,500 people in Talca Park the other night. Isn't that a great news story for Irish sport?
It is. Now, you said a second.
Yeah, the second one is an old mate of mine, Paul Murphy, Primetime Investigates reporter. Did you see the show last week where he did an expose on Katrina Carey, former Irish international soccer, or hockey player, and sorry, I have soccer on the brain here. But I thought that was a wonderful piece of investigative journalism. And what I thought was incredible was he managed to persuade people who had a bad experience, maybe had reason to feel embarrassed about being taken in, et cetera, to go on television, tell their story. And as a result of that, there's a file currently being prepared before the DPP, or an investigation is taking place. And I think that is wonderful journalism. So I'd hire him in a heartbeat as well.
God, you're hiring everybody at the moment. That's good.
It. Well, that's the end of that. That's the end of that.
Peter, please come back and we will talk law. Yes.
By the way, can I just give a very honourable mention to my colleague Mark Tottenham, who helps me on Law on Trial, who was very informative in relation to the cases that I just brought to you today. I robbed a lot of information off him. He is the expert in expert witnesses and handwriting evidence. So I just want to credit him with some of the information that has been given to your listeners today.
And you should also tell me, when will we hear part two of Law on Trial?
It's coming back. We're recording the first episode on the 7th of March. And our main interviewee is Emily O'Reilly, European Ombudsman. So we're very excited about that.
A woman I know very well.
Yes. And someone who's doing Ireland proud abroad.
She is too. Brilliant.
And has a lot of important stuff to say.
Very good. All right, Peter, thanks so much. And because that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 76. Please share, like, retweet this podcast with all your connections on social media. And do it now, please, before you forget. It's a click of a button to you. It's commercial success for us. Make it easy on yourself to enjoy your favorite business podcast by subscribing on your favorite podcast platform. That makes sure that Ireland's best business podcast, That Great Business Show, is always on your phone or wherever. And of course, talk to us, as so many do, on our LinkedIn page. Just like your business, we're a commercial business, so why not advertise with us? We have the best informed business audience in the country that needs to know about your business. Great brands like Big Red Cloud, ISME, Virgin Media, Uderos na Gaeltachta already back us, and they'll be joined by Microfinance Ireland next month. Contact us today for more information. And as always, my thanks to the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studios, including today's super sound engineer, Mark McCarthy, and Peter Rice, who every week adds his spit and polish to make us unquestionably the world's best sounding podcast. And as always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto, made in Mayo, sold worldwide, and founded by Tom Murphy, a great supporter of That Great Business Show. And don't forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have a regular column all about the podcast. So from me, Conall O'Moran, vor míle buíochas, agus slán tamall.